This is the Tom Hartman Show on Nova M Phoenix 1480 KPHX.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from our Phoenix affiliate, KPHX, and pleased to be out here. Well, yesterday we had there were four progressive talk show hosts and 1,500 of our close friends, and it was a wild and crazy time. Me and Bill Press and Stephanie Miller and Mike Malloy, all broadcasting here from Phoenix as the radio station, did a big first year anniversary party. It was a hoot. Friday night, I attended a gig that where Karl Rove was speaking, and I'll be filling you in on that a little bit later on. But first, and a lot of the news of the day, particularly interesting, how the Russian press is playing the departure of Don Imus. But we'll get to all that in a few minutes. Right now, Dorlinda Bordley is with us. She's the executive director and senior counsel to the Bioethics Defense Fund. Their website is bdfund.org. The Senate is debating federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. And Dorlinda, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Looking over your website, ranging from quotes from the Pope to ringing denouncements of abortion to the description of stem cell research as cloning, I get it that you're not pleased that the Senate might be considering, and the House for that matter, might be considering federally funding use of embryonic stem cells in research.
Well, of course, people on both sides of the debate are all for cures and for aggressive science. And so what we're really opposing is a corporate welfare where the American taxpayers will be funding big biotech interests in a failed science experiment that happens to use human embryos and require, you know, untold amounts of eggs from women to exploit their health.
Now, if the funding goes through the normal channels, and I have some marginal familiarity with this, but some familiarity with this, if this is funded through the National Institutes of Health, then the vast majority of that funding, although the consequences of the research, like with drug pharmaceutical research, for example, and a lot of surgical research, for that matter, may end up in the hands, surgical device research, may end up in the hands of for-profit corporations being sold to us. The research itself is typically done at not-for-profit universities all over the United States. Am I missing something here?
No, you're not. But the not-for-profit universities that are using our tax dollars to build their labs and so forth, those university professors who present themselves as, you know, unbiased, you know, researchers are actually owners, many of them, owners of private biotech companies. And so this is a federal subsidy that floats their biotech businesses because their private dollars severely dropped out about 3 or 4 years ago when the private investors saw that the big promises and hype of embryonic stem cell research came up with nothing but tumors. They lost their private investor dollars, and that's when they started mobilizing into asking for our tax dollars to float their failing businesses.
Are you suggesting that investment in embryonic stem cell research in the United States has been declining?
Absolutely. If you look at the Wall Street Journal 2004 article, said that there was a $4.2 billion loss in the biotech industry, largely due to the failures of embryonic stem cell research. And you have to realize, you know, as an attorney, that there's a patent financial incentive here. When we use adult stem cells, which are cells from our own body that, you know, you don't have to create human embryos to destroy, when adult stem cell treatments and cures, of which there are over 70 diseases, are used, the biotech people can't mass produce that. They can help you get better. They do help you get better, but they can't patent that because it's your own body cells. However, they can and have patented embryonic stem cell lines. So you have people at Harvard and University of Wisconsin and universities in California These are scientists who personally own patents to embryonic stem cell lines, and then they sell them to other universities and make money, even though they're not developing any cures whatsoever.
Yeah, Darlinda, we're talking with Darlinda Bordley, who is the executive director and senior counsel for the Bioethics Defense Fund, BDFund.org, a group that opposes federal funds for stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research. And in fact, I would say probably opposes all embryonic stem cell research, period. I don't think I'm mischaracterizing your position.
I agree with you
that the revolving door between universities and corporations has become as bizarre and essentially incestuous as has been the revolving door between big corporations and government, particularly during the last 6 years, although this is something that's been growing ever since, in particular since the Reagan administration. But what does that have to, and that is an argument that, frankly, I think both of us can make. I mean, I make that argument strongly in a book I wrote called Unequal Protection, but it has nothing to do with whether or not embryonic stem cell research is something that's worthy of our collective attention as a society. The fact that it may be being done or maybe being delivered in a way that we agree is imperfect doesn't minimize the fact that there have been some apparent dramatic successes coming out of this stuff in a variety of areas, including spinal cord injuries, blood diseases, all of this so far with lab animals, but it's there and it's happening.
All of the dramatic progress that you have seen is from adult stem cells, and that's a big difference. Embryonic stem cells come from destroying human embryos. Adult stem cells come from our own blood, fat, there's amniotic fluid, even teeth and hair. There are stem cells that, of course, we all would support and that are actually helping people that are already working. So why would we need to go down the route of sinking, very limited research dollars into something like embryonic stem cell research that not only causes an ethical divide, but has also resulted in nothing but tumors, when we have something in our own bodies that works and that is being federally funded?
I get it. So you're saying that you are not familiar with all the research that has been published in the scientific literature and in the mass media about the embryonic stem cell research work that has been done on animals?
No, I'm very familiar with all of the research, and I can tell you that there is zero, and I invite you to go look for yourself, zero human clinical trials, or even in animals, and even that rat study that people so irresponsibly cite was used largely from tissues from an adult rat. And so that has been debunked, and I could get you information on that. So there has been zero animal or human treatments or progress from embryonic stem cell research.
I respectfully disagree. The literature is all over the place. I mean, I'm sorry that,
I didn't find one. Find one, and I'd be happy to come on and apologize.
Okay, well, I would suggest I send you over to the Center for American Progress. They did an entire summary on this. It's called Divided We Fall, The Need for National Stem Cell Funding. And in that, they cite a lot of the research. And you can find it at Think Progress, or excuse me, at AmericanProgress.org. That's just a summary. This stuff is out there. The bottom line here is you view this as a moral issue. You know, the Wall Street Journal, you quoted the Wall Street Journal from 2004. The Wall Street Journal on April 14th, 2007 had an article by John Gill and Pete Sessions in which they suggested, how about a compromise? Isn't there some way? In fact, here's the quote. They say, as Congress debates this issue, one has to ask, can there be a middle ground that would give the scientists the stem cells they need and at the same time not violate the sanctity of life? I would submit to you that, and they say, we think there is. I would submit to you, and that, first of all, we have a problem with the definition of life, and the second, and we have a little less than a minute here for your response, I'm sorry, but, and the second is that we, every day, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of embryos are flushed down sinks in vitro fertilization labs across the United States. Do you want to shut down those IVF labs?
Look, the issue about the sanctity of human life is something that is, at the heart of the culture war. And so, just like abortion, as you mentioned. And so this legislation that is before the Senate and before the President is whether Americans who do have different ideas on the valuation of human life, and biologically it is human life, whether they should have to pay for the destruction of what is biologically and factually human life. And so whether that happens or doesn't happen, it's going to happen. But do we have to pay for it? And I think that Americans would say, just like we don't have to pay for abortion, we shouldn't have to pay for this either.
Darlinda Bordley, Executive Director at Senior Counsel, BDFund.org. Thanks, Darlinda. It's interesting to hear your point of view. 16 minutes past the hour. Past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. JR in Vancouver, BC. Hey, JR, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's Vancouver, Washington.
Uh-huh. Okay, all the better.
Yeah, you know, that woman's arguments don't really hold water. I mean, she's saying that she doesn't think the American public want to pay for this. The statistics show that a large American population does want it, but they don't want this ideological war that the president is in, and regardless of what we feel, he's willing to wage this. I look at it.
Yeah, we'd really rather not pay to destroy 600,000 human lives in Iraq. Thank you very much.
And the
larger frame here, I think, is this whole issue of when does life begin, and we really need to be having that discussion in the United States again, whether it has to do with embryonic stem cell research or anything, or abortion or anything else, frankly, because there are many of us who, and I put myself in this camp, who don't think that six divided cells in a petri dish, or actually it wouldn't be six, it would be 4, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, it's a binary. But in any case, 64 divided human cells on a petri dish or sitting in liquid nitrogen that are fertilized as a result of an in vitro fertilization process where, they may have 10, 20, 30, 50 eggs that have been fertilized and they're going to try and implant one in an infertile woman, or they put in two or three hoping that one will stick, and what are they going to do with the rest? They flush them down the drain. I frankly don't think that's the destruction of human life. And
well, I don't either.
That matters here.
If you think about it, the critics of this particular bill are using their religious ideology as a defense mechanism. And as far as I remember, there's supposed to be a separation of church and state. So if they're going to make an argument against this, there has to be an argument that is not religiously based.
Yeah, I agree. And frankly, that's why I think that they're saying, this leads to tumors, or this leads to, or nobody has actually done this research. It's just the body of research. You would have to have not been watching the news for the last 5 years. It's extraordinary. Bob in Westchester, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom. Great show. She's being a little misleading on these issues about adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells. I have a sister and a brother-in-law who have spinal cord injuries, and long-term spinal cord injuries are being rejuvenated through these embryonic stem cells. They don't have the ability in adult stem cell lines
in smaller mammals. So far they've done that research on rats.
Research in 1999, they severed a rat's neck and they rejuvenated through embryonic stem cells. And I would ask her, how long have they been studying adult stem cell lines as opposed to studying embryonic? And it's been 40 years as opposed to 7 years. So I think it's a very misleading, this argument about the life. And are they holding funerals for these embryos when they flush them down the toilet? I don't think so.
Right, or for that matter, about half, I think the 40% is the number that I read, about half of all human pregnancies, actually, or not pregnancies, half of all fertilized eggs, where the sperm meets the egg in the fallopian tubes, never attach in the uterus, and thus don't become a pregnancy. 40%.
that's the only place they can survive, Tom. I mean, they can't survive.
Yeah, I know. Which means that if a woman is having, if a couple is having sex regularly and the woman has a menstrual period, the odds are, you know, fairly reasonable that at least every other or every third or whatever, every fourth period is actually a fertilized embryo going down the drain. Should they be having funerals, you know, around menstrual? I mean, this is how bizarre it gets, and it really concerns me that this absolutely rigid religious perspective is beginning to contaminate the idea of scientific research. Bob, thank you for your comments. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Tom, this issue to me is very personal. You're on the West Coast. You familiar with an acoustic duo called Lowen and Navarro? The reason
no.
I bring them up, okay. Eric Lowen is a guitar player, great musician. He has a condition called ALS, which I think we commonly call Lou Gehrig's disease.
Sure.
I'm watching this person deteriorate in front of me. Every time I see him, I talk to him, he's a little worse. He's at a point where he needs help going on and off the stage. He can barely hold a guitar. I mean, there's nothing modern medicine can do at the current time. Stem cell research is the only hope we have. I mean, I have a personal challenge to your guest. I would love for her to go to an ALS clinic or any place where these people have any kind of deteriorating neurological diseases and debate the morality of her issue.
But this is the problem. When somebody is operating out of a position that they believe to be absolute black and white, moral, right and wrong, then everything that is on the, oh, that must be wrong side, is discounted. And everything that might attach to the right, so I can't speak for my guest, and I'm not going to try to. It wouldn't be fair to her, and it wouldn't be fair to you. But the people that we've had this discussion before. It's just very timely right now, because this legislation is probably going to end up going to the president in the next week or so. And this debate is going to be coming out. And I would guess that in all probability the comment from the right, not even the right, from the religious right, would be, if you can do it with embryonic stem cells, you can do it with adult stem cells, and you don't have to destroy human life, which puts it all back into the frame of this is human life. And I beg to differ. I'm sorry. I don't think that in an unimplanted embryo is, or it's not even an embryo, it's a zygote. I'm not even sure it's a zygote. It's a blast cell of some kind. Is human life. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Show on Nova M Phoenix, 1480 KPHX.
Four minutes past the hour. 2002. 2002. The first serious study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. December of 2002. Stanford scientists used special chemicals to transform undifferentiated embryonic stem cells of mice into cell masses that resemble islets found in the mouse pancreas. When this tissue is transplanted into diabetic mice, it produces insulin in response to high glucose levels in the animals. In 2002, 5 years ago, isn't that 5 years? Yeah, 5 years ago, they successfully healed type 1 diabetes in mice using embryonic stem cells. Also, researchers at the Whitehead Institute in Cambridge, Mass. Use embryonic stem cells. This was published in Cell, which is the magazine for people in the business of looking into cells. It's a peer-reviewed scientific journal. Researchers at the Whitehead Institute at Cambridge, Mass. Used embryonic stem cells created through somatic stem nuclear transfer, SCNT, to cure a genetic defect in mice. This method allowed them to create embryonic stem cells identical to the animal, correcting the genetic defect in the cells in a petri dish, and then inject the cells back inside the mouse. The experiment shows proof of principle for using SCNT to cure disease. 2003, the next year, 4 years ago, this was published in the Journal of American National Biotechnical Journal. Again, another peer-reviewed scientific publication. Homologous recombination in human embryonic stem cells. Scientists at the University of Wisconsin-Madison report developing methods for recombining segments of DNA within human embryonic stem cells. This advance should make it possible to manipulate any small part of the human genome to study gene function and mimic human disease in a laboratory dish. Tweaking the cells with specific gene changes might enhance their true therapeutic potential or make them more compatible with patients' immune systems. And then another study that was published also in Cell, and that was also, in fact, published, two different studies published in Cell, the same issue, the May 30th, 2003 issue. Master stem cell gene identified. Researchers in Japan and Scotland on this one. Another one. Researcher creates 17 embryonic stem cell lines with private funding. Harvard University molecular biologist Douglas Melton announced in November 2003. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that his lab developed 17 human embryonic stem cell lines and plans to provide the cells to the American Type Culture Collection in Virginia. Also in 2003, this study published in Nature. Nature is probably the most solid. Nature and Science are, you know, at least the top of my list. I'm a member of AAAS, so I get Science, and have subscribed to Nature for years. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, and four other institutions report that stem cells from adult bone marrow does not appear to have the ability to transform into other cell types, contradicting earlier studies suggesting the cells have this capacity. So, in other words, it's embryonic stem cells or nothing is how it looked in 2003. 2004. I'm not gonna read all. I've got page after page. 2004, 2005, 2006, all the way up to today. We're finding this stuff works. So the question is, you know, is it works, and are we going to use it to keep people alive? Carol in Lakeview, New York. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to say that, can you hear me?
I can.
Yes, okay. Yep. I just wanted to say that I don't think the right-wing Christian coalition is knowledgeable about the Bible, because if you look at the first book of the Bible, Genesis, chapter 2, approximately 8 verse 8 through 10, it says, God breathed into man and made him a living soul. So it's not until the child takes its first breath is he considered alive or a living soul by the Bible. So that a late-term abortion where a child takes that first breath, if that child's life was put at that point, that would be considered a sin. And if you have the death penalty where a man or woman is walking around breathing and put them to death, that's a sin. Or if you're bombing shock and awe in Iraq or wherever, and you kill those people, regardless of their political party, that's a sin. So that's just about what I'd like to say.
Let's have a culture of life that protects life that's already living. That'd be a fine place to start. It just seems like a fine place to start. Carol, thank you for a well-expressed point. Richard in Seattle. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
This is a passionate thing for me. I know people who work in the genetics field. I have a father with Alzheimer's. I understand what stem cells can and may do someday.
I want to second that. My mother has Alzheimer's, and one of my very best friends, Michael Hutchison, another writer, about, 8 years ago or so. In fact, his whole story is over at my website at tomhartman.com/Hutchison, HUTCHISON.SHTML. Michael Hutchison fell, and he was jogging, and he fell off a bridge with a low abutment on an icy day in Santa Fe, broke his neck, and is essentially paralyzed from the neck down and has been all these years. He's had some extraordinary experiences as a consequence of that, many of them very negative, some of them rather positive. But here's a guy who it looks like this type of research has the potential to allow him to walk and use his hands again. I mean, he's working on a book right now.
The research of stem cells is just amazing, and the potential of what can be done is also amazing. But your guest made a very important point that was kind of pushed aside, that the difference between legally, patentably, the difference between stem cells and using adult stem cells, whichever may be most fruitiously proven in the future research, is that if they use your own cells, as a basis for the medicine, they can't patent it. They're developing stem cell lines so they can own whole genetic lines of human cells. And the point is much larger than just stem cells. In all sorts of areas of research, because patents are held on particular points of genetic code, research is stymied. People don't get anything done because you have to pay royalties to some university or, in many cases, a corporation that owns those patent rights. And you can no longer do research in that area without
I understand. I understand, Richard. And that brings the point back that I was saying to her is maybe we should be talking about the problem, the corporate and governmental and university problems, all this these bizarre relationships that all have to do with trying to make a buck rather than debating whether or not we should be
I summed it up for your screener in just one sentence, and that is, if you really want to protect the sanctity of life, don't let them patent it. Don't let the corporations own life.
There you go. There you go. And I'd say that goes for genetically modified organisms.
Anything.
For
you know,
plants.
In Iraq, part of the uprisings they have is they've taken away their native crops and forced upon them these genetic hybrid killer
death. Yeah, we got this wonderful stuff from Monsanto for
Monsanto,
you.
Monsanto, yeah. Monsanto's turning around and patenting gene lines of grains that have been in generations of those native families.
Yeah. Indeed. Well said. Thank you very much, Richard. Good to hear from you. Sarah in San Diego, you're taking the contrary view on this.
Hey, Tom. I'm gonna try to just rush through everything I have to say. I live in San Diego, and I supply equipment to preclinical studies, not only at EDUs and nonprofits, but also at some of the world's biggest for-profit organizations. And you know, you were absolutely right. There's a huge difference between embryonic and adult cells. Adult cells you can use, you know, for that one person. Embryonic cells have such a broader use. More importantly, if you use adult cells, it's financially not an option as far as cures go, because you have someone who is ill or injured or very close to the end of their life, and to harvest those cells from them, create what you need to create, make the cure you need to make, and get that person healed in such a short period of time, it would be a ridiculous amount of money to equip hospitals and research centers with that much equipment to be able to do any real amount of healing.
Well, I'm not quite ready, Sarah, to throw out the idea of adult stem cell research as well. I think it may be possible that, you know, you could arguably patent a technique or a technology or machinery or
right.
whatever, you know, to pull out a little bit of bone marrow and convert it into something you can re-inject. I saw on TV last night there a special about how there's this guy in Russia doing this, peddling it as a cure-all, and it looks like quack medicine to me, but you know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, conceivably could be done.
But your point
is that embryonic stem cell research is really the holy grail of the whole thing here.
It is. And the other comment that she made that just made me laugh was there are a lot or a vast majority of research and nonprofit that are owners of private companies. And I'll tell you, I work with both, and I'm not seeing a lot of researchers at UCSD that, you know, own stock in any of the, you know, big companies. They're not making that kind of money. They're not, you know, they're doing nonprofit work, and that's what they do. So
Good point, you know. Thank you very much. And thank you very much, and well said. Eileen in Manhattan. Hey, Eileen, we'd have just a few seconds before we have to take a break.
Okay, Tom, I'll make it fast. You asked this question of your guest, and I've never heard it answered ever. If they're going to throw them away anyway, then what's your beef? You know,
right. Well, the actual answer, and she didn't say it, but the official Catholic Church answer is don't allow them to be created in the first place. Don't allow in vitro fertilization.
But they won't address IVF.
Right, and they don't want to talk about it because it's politically very unpopular. But that is their position. I'm quite sure. So, Eileen, thank you for the call. It's 45 minutes past the hour. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. What? I got a note from a listener here that said actually referring back to an old Al Franken show, said Al Franken once had a guest on who made the point, I think this is great, who once made the point, I don't care when life begins, I care when it's viable. Arguably, when you brush your teeth, you're flushing down the drain cells that are alive that could be used to heal or fix a human being, or could be this most recent study that just came out, you know, in the last couple of weeks, where they're using the adult stem cells to create sperm cells, essentially. So arguably, using this technology, a woman could fertilize herself. And with any kind of cells. I mean, it's a good point. Let's see here, Donna in Memphis, Tennessee. Hey, Donna, welcome to the program.
Hi, I just wanted to make the point that I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma last summer, and my treatment actually involved monoclonal antibodies that came from stem cells. Rituxan. I had two rounds of Rituxan and the tumor started shrinking, and after four rounds it disappeared. Rituxan is being used not only on lymphoma now, it's actually now in clinical trials for breast cancer.
And this is a drug or a substance that is derived from embryonic stem cells?
I'm not sure if it's from embryonic or adult stem cells, but as far as I'm concerned, stem cells saved my life.
Yeah. That's
it's just that plain and simple for me.
Yeah.
And how many other people out there can it save their lives as well? I'm 43 years old, and I had a stage 2 cancer that was it was the most aggressive non-Hodgkin's that they have, and... Mm. They saved my life, and they're using Rituxan now for a number, other than even breast cancer, they're using it for pancreatic cancer. It's considered to be the frontline treatment now for lymphomas and leukemias.
That's great. Donna, thank you so much for the heads up on that and for the information. That's extraordinary. Debbie in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, Debbie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was just listening to your program, and... a woman called and said that these frozen embryos are just going to be thrown away anyway. Why not use them? Well, two things. One, if it's a business, there might be more people donating just for the process of developing these stem lines, which would lead to more loss of life. And another thing...
That you believe that a fertilized ovum that has not been implanted into a uterus is life.
I certainly do, because if it were implanted in the uterus, it would become a child. And, well, it is a child in the earliest stages. And the reason I know this is because there are people who are adopting these frozen embryos.
They're implanting them. It's a snowflake baby program, that was started by the Right Life folks back about, 8 years ago or so? So here's the question, Debbie. There are an estimated 100,000 embryos a year, frozen embryos, that get flushed down the sink. And there's maybe 20 or 30 of them that are turned into snowflake babies, to use your phrase. What do we do with these 99,700 or 980? Should there be funerals for all of them?
Well,
I'm not gonna
answer the question, but I will say if more people knew about the snowflake adoptions, there's at least 128 snowflake children now. The oldest are 8 years old, and
I think it's a marvelous thing that if people want to do that. I can tell you, having worked in the field, there are hundreds of thousands of children in the United States desperately in need of adoptive parents, and these are children who are already alive. So, in my opinion, this whole snowflake baby thing was more about making the point that these frozen embryos potentially could become humans, as opposed to trying to help anybody out particularly. Because for every one of those babies that was born, there's some child, actual born living, lonely child out there looking for a family that doesn't get one. you know, assuming that those people would have adopted had they not been able to do this.
Right.
But and even in the process of producing these so-called snowflake babies, if they're implanting four or five of these frozen embryos in a woman, hoping that one catches, you got three that are going to be passed out or absorbed by the body or whatever. I mean, is that destroying human life? I mean, is a sperm and an egg that haven't hit each other yet in the fallopian tubes? Do those represent human life? I mean, the Catholic Church's position is yes. That's why you have abstinence rather than birth control. I mean, how far back do we push this thing?
Well, God himself made a lot of sperm and a lot of eggs that we're never going to meet. So I think that's in God's hands, and the snowflake babies are too. If four or five are implanted and only one or two make it, then God chose to take those others home.
At that point, it's a natural or a supernatural process.
Exactly.
Debbie, thank you for your perspective.
I had one more thing. The umbilical stem cells.
Mm-hmm.
When babies are born, you can take stem cells out of their umbilical cord.
Yes.
And that has been done, and that has been successful.
Yeah, and there's a lot of promise with those, and I hope we see a lot more work, a lot more research on that. Good point, Debbie. Thank you very much. Ray in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Ray, we just have a few seconds here before we have to wrap this hour up.
Just wanted to suggest that you ask these people that are against it how many of these embryos they personally have had implanted and carried to term. How many of the snowflake babies they have personally adopted.
Yeah, okay. And another point, Ray, thank you very much. Another point, can you take a tax deduction for them? You know, can you list them as dependents? I don't, it's a sad rhetorical comment. 57 minutes past the hour. Arnold Schwarzenegger building a death chamber in California? Capital punishment? We'll be right back.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. I want to bring around a whole collection of things that meet each other, I guess, or match into each other. The idea of what happened at Duke University. These guys had great lawyers and a lot of resources to pursue this thing for a long time and thus get exonerated. And obviously there was, or apparently, you know, I would say it's pretty obvious, but you wait until the trial, right? Apparently there was prosecutorial misconduct, shall we say, at the very least, on the part of Mr. Niflung, the DA, who might have been doing this as a stunt to get himself reelected or whatever. I mean, you know, we don't know. Nobody knows exactly why or exactly what. That will be investigated and is being pursued. But the point is not to minimize what happened to these young men, and I'm not. And they had the best representation money can buy. At the same time, there are people all over the United States who have no access to representation. Or at the very least, or at the very most, have access to a public defender. Because they have no money. They're not from wealthy families. They're very often not white. They're not middle class. They're not upper middle class. They're not the rich. They don't have the ability to defend themselves. They are charged with crimes, not just rape, but in many cases murder, and not just murder, premeditated murder, capital murder. And as we look at the statistics now, speaking of the right to life, by the way, this is, as I say, we're drawing together a whole bunch of different threads here, from the Duke rape case to Don Imus and the whole issue, the whole discussion of race in America, to Arnold Schwarzenegger having to go to the legislative branch in California to get permission to do anything that costs over $400,000. And so he builds a death chamber in the state, or one gets built. I guess his culpability in this is an ongoing saga. Gets built for $399,000. This is the story in the San Francisco Chronicle, I believe it was. Dateline Sacramento. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's administration has quietly built a new execution chamber at San Quentin State Prison, prompting angry lawmakers who learned about the construction just this last week to accuse the governor of hiding the project from the legislature and the public. And by the way, I am going to get to telling you the story of what happened when I went to see Karl Rove on Friday night, but in a few minutes. The problem that these guys have with all these death chambers is that you, in order for an execution to be certified in the United States, there have to be witnesses. And in order for there to be witnesses, you've got to find people who are going to, they're going to watch this thing. And I mean, the reality is that it's possible to kill people with a capsule. You can say, here, put this in your mouth and drink a glass of water. In fact, in Vermont, in the state where I live, although I'm broadcasting today from Phoenix, in the state where I live, the law says that if you can get two doctors to certify that you're within 6 months of dying and you're in pain, and they agree with you that you should be allowed to end your own life, they can write you a prescription for a drug that you can go to a pharmacy and buy, and I believe it's simply an overdose of barbiturates. I may be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. It's just a very, very large dose of barbiturates. They will write you a prescription for this. You can go to the pharmacy and fill it. You can set that pill bottle next to your bed, and you can sit and look at it. And one of the fascinating things that they found, by the way, not to digress too much here, was that because we've had legalized, what would you call it? It's called the Death with Dignity Law. Legalized suicide at the end of life in Oregon for a couple of years now, is that it actually reduces the level of suicides, because people, if they're frantic and they don't know what to do and they feel like they can't tell anybody and there's nobody they can talk to about it, and they're more likely to grab a gun and blow their brains out. But if they've got a pill bottle there and they know all they've got to do is just take this pill and drink a glass of water and within an hour I'll be dead, they look at it and say, well, I'll wait another hour. I'll wait another 2 hours. I'll wait another 4 hours. I'll wait another day. And it turns out that people who get these prescriptions are less likely to commit suicide than equally sick people before we had the law. But as I said, that's a bit of a tangent. But the reason I mention that is because the push for executions, whether it was the electric chair, which was really Thomas Edison trying to promote DC, direct current, DC electricity, over his competitor George Westinghouse and Tesla, who had come up with AC, alternating current, and he was trying to prove how deadly AC was. So he created the electric chair, seriously, to demonstrate how deadly AC was so people would be afraid of it. Well, we have AC now. In any case, Edison lost the science on that as well as the case. But the point of developing the electric chair, developing the gas chamber with the cyanide gas, the hangings, the shootings, all of these different techniques, the goal was always to make it fast. And the reason that they wanted to make it fast was not because it would be less painful for the person dying. You can argue that the cyanide gas chamber was brutal. It wasn't for that reason. It was so that the witnesses could get done with it. Because, who wants to watch somebody die? So if we're going to have state-sanctioned murders, state-sanctioned executions in the United States, the goal was always, how can we do it fast for the convenience of the jailers and of the people who are the witnesses? And the simple fact of the matter is, if you gave prisoners who were going to die at the state's hand, which is something that, frankly, I think should not happen, but if you were to give them the same barbiturate overdose or whatever the drug is that is given in Oregon for people at the end of life, they would simply take a pill and lay down and die. But it would take an hour or two for that drug. At first they'd fall asleep, and then the levels are going to accumulate in their bloodstream to the point where they just slowly stop breathing and die. So there is a technology for death that's relatively painless, and where you could argue that we're being a little more civilized. But here's the problem. Since the mid-1970s, 1976, the death penalty in the United States was re-legalized. Since that time, over 120 people on death row have been proven to be innocent of the crimes for which they were convicted. And this was where I started with the whole Duke rape thing, is that these were people who did not have the means to have a lawyer who could fight this all the way to the end. 122 people. For every 8 people who have been executed in the United States since 1976, for every 8 executions, there has been one person who has been exonerated, who has been found to be on death row. We have no idea how many of those who were executed actually weren't guilty, because once they're dead, the enormous time and effort and money that goes into proving their innocence with DNA and other kinds of things just doesn't get done. But if one of 8, if one of 9, excuse me, for every 8, there's one free. If one of 9 is later exonerated from people on death row right now, then I think it's reasonable to assume that one of 9 in all probability, or about 10%, 11%, 12% of the people on death row who were executed. You know, the 100 or so people that George Bush, you know, gleefully talks about, you know, pull the plug on. I mean, he killed more people as governor of Texas than any other governor in the history of the United States. And you look at the percentage of exonerations, 62% of them are black, 12% Latino, 48% white. You look at the states where it happened, there have been 22 in Florida, 18 in Illinois, causing the governor of Illinois to say, enough already. 18 people on death row who were not guilty? We're not going to kill anybody else. In Arizona, 8%. Excuse me, eight exonerations, 8 in Louisiana, 8 in Texas, 7 in Oklahoma. This is extraordinary. We're averaging, since 1998, we've been averaging between 7 and 9 a year. And that's just, you know, because there's not that many people out there who can do it. I submit to you that when the state executes living human beings, not only does it not serve as a deterrent to crime, we know that. Not only does it not save the state money, because the cost associated with making sure that they're actually innocent or they're actually guilty is enormous, but it also brutalizes us as society. It brutalizes us right across the board. And so I call on Governor Schwarzenegger to dismantle his death chamber that he just built for, you know, a dollar less than the legislature needed to overlook. 16 minutes past the hour.
As a young man, I found politics in the Bush's army door. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, some of the statistics and information I was providing to you are from the Death Penalty Information Center. You can Google it. It's just a wealth of information. Think of all the nations in the world that are civil, that, you know, we think of as fully developed civilized countries, countries that have, they got it together. Things are working well. People have a decent lifestyle. They have a decent standard of living. There's a reasonable middle class. They're not in a constant state of war with each other. They're not belligerent. There's a good economy. Good, you know, infant mortality is low. Lifespan is long. Food is available. Think of those countries. You just, I mean, what comes to mind, right? Norway, Sweden, England, France, Germany, some of the European countries, some of the Middle Eastern countries, some of the countries in Southeast Asia, Costa Rica comes to my mind, in South America, in Central and South America, the United States, you would think. But as you're thinking of all of the countries in the world that you would describe as civilized, now you've got that, your own mental list, right? Now let's see if any of those countries on that list show up on this list of the countries of the world that still have the death penalty. Everybody else has banned it. The majority of countries in the world have banned the death penalty. The United Nations Convention on Human Rights condemns the death penalty. Here are the countries that still have it. Afghanistan, Algeria, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Botswana, Burundi, China, Congo, Cuba, Egypt, Ethiopia, Guatemala, India, Indonesia, Iran, Iraq, Japan, Jordan, well, Japan, an exception, Jordan, Kuwait, Laos, Lebanon, Libya, Malaysia, Mongolia, Myanmar, used to be Burma, Nigeria, North Korea, not South. South Korea has banned the death penalty. The Philippines, Qatar, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, Sudan, Syria, Taiwan, Thailand, that surprises me, Uganda, the United Arab Emirates, the United States of America, Vietnam, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. That's it. That's our company. The vast majority of those countries, brutal dictatorships, countries in absolute chaos. That's your death penalty bunch. But what I really like doing with this, and really, you know, one of the luxuries that we have with this program, is being able to put things in the very largest frame possible. Because this is a subject that highlights the fact that there is no real, truly colorblind, class-blind, income-blind income system in the United, or justice system in the United States. That the justice system in the United States, in fact, regularly fails. It is highly imperfect. Somebody is wealthy, somebody is well-connected, whether it's criminal law or whether it's, for that matter, bankruptcy law. I mean, Donald Trump declaring bankruptcy in Vegas. It's a business decision compared with, you know, some poor individual who has tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills because they had the bad fortune, or in the minds of most conservatives, the bad morality of getting ill, even if they were insured, and they get wiped out and no more credit for you. Sorry, Charlie. We have an absolutely inconsistent system in the United States. And then to apply that absolutely inconsistent system, that system that has a long history of institutional and endemic, not just racism, but racism and classism and sexism, to apply that system to the execution, the public execution of human beings, in my opinion, is not only barbaric, but just plain old dumb. I mean, you know, it's like saying, oh yeah, our system is absolutely perfect. It's so perfect that we're willing to kill people. And then you get these guys who come on and say, I don't want, you know, the post office, we shouldn't have a national health insurance program because anything the government does, they're going to screw up. Well, let me get this right, Joe Republican. You don't think that we should have a national health care program because you don't trust the government to get you well. But you do think we should have public executions of people convicted of violent crimes, particularly murder, because you trust the government absolutely 100% of the time to get it right. That all of those people on death row are absolutely guilty, there's no doubt in your mind. To quote George W. Bush, he was once asked, you know, did you ever have any doubts about all that 100-some-odd people that you executed down there in Texas? He said, nope. No doubts in my mind. None whatsoever. Alberto Gonzalez, by the way, prepared the summaries for him when he signed the death warrants. And I don't recall if it was Bush or Gonzalez. One of them, in an interview, proudly proclaimed that Bush never spent more than 20 minutes evaluating one. How many of those people were innocent that he put to death? Do we really want this in our society? Your call's next. 27 minutes past the hour. And bringing it back to Don Imus. Welcome back. Bringing it back around, which is, you know, where I started this thing. I said, let's pull all this stuff together. What Don Imus' situation, in my mind, what this represents is that the cultural consensus in America has changed. That in the 60s and 70s, we started saying, hey, wait a minute, we want to bring, you know, with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action and anti-poverty programs, we said we want to bring everybody into the fold. We, the American middle class is big enough to encompass everybody who's in the United States. Let's bring everybody into the fold, and let's all work together here as humans and as citizens and as patriots, and we're all part of the same family. And part of that meant not trashing people for their race or their gender or their political point of view. And the right, then, when Reagan came along in 1980 and declared war against the American middle class and proclaimed the idea that, you know, a social consensus like that was nonsense and that it should be appropriate to have a rigidly class-oriented society. And greed is good. And we don't need small mom-and-pop shops anymore. We don't need entrepreneurs. We'll stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and let the big company just gobble them all up. I remember in the 60s and 70s, every shopping mall in America looked different. Every single store was locally owned, and they all looked different. Well, not every single one. You may have an anchor store that was a Sears or something, but pretty much they were all locally owned. And throughout the, if you, those of you old enough to remember, the decade of the 80s, the Reagan decade, all of that changed. Because you had this mergers and acquisition mania and all this stuff, everybody buying all this stuff. So the social consensus then became more pro-corporate, more pro-class strategy, class consciousness, more accepting of culturally ingrained racism and of speaking of it in ways that tipped the hat to it, that validated that racism and classism and sexism, and the capsule, the frame that was used to describe all this was PC or political correctness. And throughout the 80s, then you had this rise of voices on the right saying, oh, that's PC, that's politically correct, how you're afraid to say things, you know, and it became very cool. And Limbaugh really got this going full tilt boogie in the late 80s when he started his radio program in 87. You know, with phrases like feminazi, it became really cool to trash people based on their gender or their race or their political perspective. Limbaugh recently trashing Barack Obama for being half African American and half Caucasian American or white American or whatever. And in my opinion, what has happened is that the cultural consensus in the United States, starting probably right around 2000. But frankly, I think that 9/11/2001 actually was a turning point because I think it dramatically accelerated this process. The cultural consensus in the United States went from that which Reagan initiated in 80-81, which was, let's divide America. Let's do away with the middle class. Let's drive all the wealth to the very wealthy, and what trickles down falls off the table. People, they can pick up the crumbs, and that'll be fine. The trickle down economics, trickle on economics, create a nation of peons. That the cultural consensus changed, and it seemed to me that it was changing around 2000, around Y2K and all that stuff, that there was this sense that, hey, there might be something bad coming. You know, the whole Y2K thing, remember that? Maybe there's something bad coming, and we should all get together. We should be concerned for each other. We should be looking out for each other's backside. The original liberal idea. The idea on which this nation was founded. And then after 2001, I think there was a very strong feeling in this country. We're all in this together. Regardless of race, regardless of religion, regardless of nationality, regardless of tribe, regardless of culture, regardless of age, regardless of education, regardless of income, we're all in this together. And Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and the whole neocon cabal have been pushing as hard as they can for the 6 years since then, and Roe, to split us apart for political gain. And in my opinion, they have been largely unsuccessful. Yes, they seized political power for a while. And, you know, everybody is looking at what they did with it and going, holy cow, not only can we not You know, not only should they, should the Supreme Court not have appointed George Bush as president, but we've got to be careful that conservatives never again have that kind of power, because look at what they did to us with it. And by the way, it's the same thing they did back in the 1920s when they brought us the Republican Great Depression. And so in my opinion, the cultural consensus in the United States is changing. And we as a people collectively are returning to our core values, the root values, the core values of the Enlightenment, of the 1600s and the 1700s, on which this country was founded. That life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, not fear, terror, and the pursuit with a gun of bad guys, that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are the core values on which this country was founded and the main purpose of our having our government, of we the people having an institution. And Imus, in my opinion, was the straw that broke the camel's back. It was because he was high profile, because he was considered, you know, mainstream and all this kind of stuff. And it just reached a point where Americans said, you know, we're sick of this. I'm broadcasting live from Phoenix today, and the station here, KPHX, had this, had this big party here over the weekend on, yesterday at the rented a disco, and 1,500 people showed up, and it was a hoot. It was great. And somebody came up to me and said, boy, I'll bet, you know, it must be really tough for you being a talk show host now with Imus. I mean, aren't you afraid to open your mouth? And I was like, no. Because I don't do hate talk. You know, it's just I'm not wired. I don't have to like start watching what I'm saying. I'm not wired that way. I'm sorry. I'm happy. So no, it doesn't. You know, I'm not concerned about it. But there are a bunch of people on the right who are very concerned about it, and they're getting very, very hysterical. Oh, the Media Matters is coming after us. Holy cow, we can't have hate talk anymore. Oh no. And finally, and then I'll take your calls. I just wanted to share this with you. Pravda, which has written two stories about me over the years, oddly enough. Pravda, a column on the 13th, on Friday the 13th, Friday of last week. I just have to share it with you. This is incredible. In a clear sign of its intent to rein in dissident American media personalities and their growing influence in American culture, U.S. war leaders this week launched an unprecedented attack upon one of their most politically connected and legendary radio hosts named Don Imus after his threats to release information relating to the September 11, 2001 attacks upon that country. According to European reports of the events surrounding Don Imus that have gripped the United States this past week, it was during an interview with another American media personality, Tim Russert, who is the host of a television program frequently viewed by U.S. war leaders, wherein while decrying the state of care being given to American war wounded, Don Imus said, quote, "So those bastards want to keep these boys, the U.S. soldiers, secret? Let's see how they would like it if I started talking about their secrets starting with 9/11. End quote. Pravda continues, "Unable to attack such a powerful media figure as Don Imus directly, the U.S. war leaders, as we have seen many times before, resorted to a massive media attack against him using the reason the racial slur against the U.S. women's basketball team, but which has been pointed out by other media outlets as not by any means a rare occurrence for the legendary radio icon to make." So Pravda is of the opinion that this is all because Don Imus was threatening to blow the whistle on 9/11, and that he said it to Tim Russert. Well, that's interesting. Everybody's got a theory, right? There's some old saying about that. Eleanor in New York. Hey, Eleanor, we've got to take a break here in about a minute. What's up?
Hi. When I called this time, it was to make a comment on the Duke lacrosse players, the case involving the Duke lacrosse players. But based on some of the other stuff that has been discussed while I've been holding, I have a couple of other comments if we have the time.
We have about 40 seconds.
Okay. In regards to the Duke lacrosse players, I was listening to Lou Dobbs tonight, the other night, and Kitty Pilgrim was hosting in place of Lou Dobbs, and she asked her questions in regards to this. Was this American justice gone wrong or something to that effect? And I was saying it was clear that absolutely no thought had preceded that question. At what America have they lived in for the last of my 53 years? That was extremely insulting, as they consider the inequality in imprisonment and sentencing faced by people of color every day. Think of the number of people wrongly imprisoned.
And look at, absolutely, and wrongly convicted and sent to death row. I mean, one out of nine people on death row is innocent. Look at all the people who are in prison on these petty drug crimes. I mean, crimes in quote. The war on drugs is in my opinion, a very, very profitable enterprise for a small slice of America, and a very effective, another tool of, frankly, racial oppression in this country. 45 minutes past the hour. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Tip of the hat to Mike Farrell. His new book, Just Call Me Mike. MikeFarrell.org, his website. Mike gave us a shout and said, here's the names of four guys who were convicted and executed, three in Texas, one in Missouri, and then it was later found that they were absolutely innocent. Ruben Cantu, Carlos de Luna, Larry Griffin, and Cameron Willingham. This is not an abstraction. This is real. It's happening. It's happening now. Ellen Ratner with us from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, you know, Mike Farrell actually turned me on to some very cool guys that we actually went out and taped. Mike is hopefully going to anchor a special show for us, and you can go to talkradionews.com and look at Exonerated, I think, is what it's listed as. And we have tapes of all of these guys who were exonerated from the death penalty.
Wow, that's great. I wish I'd known about that before I started when we were doing show prep for this hour. We just did we're in the process of doing an hour on, you know, Schwarzenegger building his new death chamber and the whole death penalty thing.
Well, the other thing you should know is that, of course, the states that have the death penalty have the higher murder rates, and look what has happened in Virginia today. I mean, I sort of say that state-sanctioned death allows people to understand that you can commit murder on some level.
I think so too, and so this hour is the real right to life hour. We're actually talking about life, the real pro-life hour, let's say. And we're absolutely pro-life. And let me just, if I may, just very quickly, Ellen, also point out. Well, actually, go ahead. You were so good.
No, I go on that.
Okay. Well, I was going to say that, you know, the 22 dead in Virginia. In one of my books, I believe it was What Would Jefferson Do? It might be in Screwed. It's one of the last couple books that I wrote. I quote at some length a study that was done in the UK that the BBC did a marvelous reporting job on, where they tracked conservative and liberal administrations in the United Kingdom over about a 45-50 year period, and they found that whenever conservatives came into power, and thus the general income of the middle class went down, social services went down, and the wealth of the very wealthy went up, the suicide rates in the United Kingdom went up. And, you know, crimes right across the board typically went up. And whenever the Liberals came into power, the Labour government, when they came into power and the welfare of average working people went up, the income of the average people went up, the social safety net got stronger, and arguably those at the very top weren't quite making out quite so well, then the suicide rates went down and violent, you know, violent crime rates went down. And I, you know,
statistic.
Here we are 6 years into this conservative binge and 26 years since Reagan really started us down this road of conservative economics of wiping out the American middle class. And
speaking of wiping out the American middle class, two interesting things. One, as you know, Sally May is now agreeing to a buyout from a private firm, $25 billion. Looks like the Senate Banking is going to have quite a bit to say about that Senate Banking Committee. And also, they're just trying to say, well, we're still going to be responsible to the SEC because they operate the public debt market. But that's a big concern. And also, the Senate Banking Committee this week is going to be taking a look at the subprime lending market because the consumer advocates say they want Congress to really look at not just the brokers and lenders, but people who are getting assigned these loans, the larger corporation that are putting together these packages. So that's going to be happening on this midweek, and also Chris Dodd is going to be meeting with all of the stakeholders in this issue, because there's a possibility that 2 million American families could lose their homes over the next 2 years.
Well, where are we at, by the way, with regard to the stem cell discussions that are going on in Congress? And I also saw a story over the weekend, and it's so far I've only seen it reported in one place, that Bush may have actually been the person who made the decision for the firing of at least one prosecutor, David Duplessis. And if so, that could be the equivalent of the, you know, Nixon conversation on the Watergate tapes that ended up getting Nixon impeached and causing him to resign because he saw the impeachment coming down
the road. Well, so far the White House has not denied that Domenici called the president and spoke with him directly on the Iglesias situation. And in fact, apparently, the Attorney General, Gonzalez, didn't make action fast enough, or didn't make action on this issue, and that prompted Domenici to call the president. And the White House has not denied that. So this is heating up in a very interesting way.
So this leads right to George W. Bush's office.
Directly, do not pass go, do not collect $200. Absolutely.
And the first part of that phrase is go to jail.
Exactly right. One other thing on Gonzalez, there's apparently a two-page letter that a new conservative group, the American Freedom Agenda, they formed to promote conservative legal principles. They actually said that Gonzalez has crippled the American Constitution's time-honored checks and balances, and they said that he is unsuitable steward of the law and should resign for the good of the country.
Now, when I hear conservative groups say that, and there have been many doing so, one of two things occurs to me. Either A, this is a group that is actually true to its principles, and if so, they should be asking for Bush's resignation as well, because everything Gonzalez has done and said, Bush has endorsed. Or B, they're trying to make Gonzalez the fall guy for Bush's policies.
Well, it's going to be very difficult to make him the fall guy if the president, and we don't know what that conversation was with Senator Domenici, and of course Senator Domenici can probably get away without testifying because of his Senate colleagues, and same goes for the president. So this may, unless there's tape.
Yeah, or emails, and I guess Bush doesn't use emails, so who knows. Interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great talking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up in our next hour, Reanne Eisler is going to be here with us about her new book, The Real Wealth of Nations, a takeoff on Adam Smith's classic tome. She will be joining me in Dubrovnik in Croatia in a couple of months, by the way. And I'm going to tell you the story, I promise, about what happened on Friday night when I went to see Karl Rove. Stick around. Tom Hartman here with you.
Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Well, as is so often the case, welcome back, by the way. So, as is so often the case, Larry Johnson gets it spot on. Tip of the hat to you, Larry, if you're listening. And tip of the hat to you, and if you're not, Larry Johnson over at type at noquarter.blogspot.com is his blog. Larry Johnson, former State Department and CIA official. He mentions breaking news. At least 22 Virginia Tech students gunned down. Cable news channels are wild with activity as they pump up the coverage, a focus on the latest crisis. He's talking about the media is commenting that this shooting is overwhelming the local medical facilities. Crisis is in the air. And then he says, okay, take a deep breath. This is horrible. This is tragic. And this gives us an idea of what it's like to live just one day in Iraq. And then he considers, just consider these news reports from Saturday, the last day for which we have a complete day in Iraq, on the 15th of April. Police found bodies of 19 people in various parts of Baghdad in the past 24 hours. 20 Iraqi troops and policemen were abducted. 4 were killed by suicide bombers in Mosul. A suicide bomber in Baghdad killed 5, wounds 11. 37 people died as a car bomb blew up near an Iraqi shrine. 65 Iraqis dead in 4 attacks. 22 Americans shot at Virginia Tech. Whoops, forgot the 20 kidnapped policemen. Can you imagine? He says. So I think it's an appropriate frame. And the larger picture here is, what kind of society are we creating all around the world? What kind of society do we want to have here at home? What kind of society do we want to live in? And I think one of the most brilliant commentators on the whole issue of the kind of society that we want to have and how economics and how culture are interrelated is Rhianne Eisler. She's the best-selling author of The Chalice and the Blade. She has a new book out. It's called The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economics. Rhianne, welcome. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you, Tom.
It is so nice to have you with us here. We received your book last week. I read it on the plane out here to Phoenix, and part of it in my hotel room. And I just love this book, from your charts of the ownership of America to your idea that economics should encompass so much more than simply what's being produced. How you define economies. Let's just get into some of this stuff. First of all, what is the real wealth of nations?
Well, you know, we're becoming more aware that it isn't financial, that the real wealth of nations, of course, are the contributions of people and of nature. And yet, we have economic systems, be they capitalist or socialist, that absolutely fail to give value to the work of caring for people and caring for our natural environment, without which none of us would be here. So basically what I'm proposing, as you know, we hear so much about thinking outside the box, and I'm saying, look, neither capitalism nor socialism have been able to solve problems, environmental problems, poverty. Let's not throw out, there are good elements in both these systems, but let's go deeper, let's go further to what I call a caring economics. And I know that putting caring and economics in the same sentence is thinking outside the box, isn't it?
Well, at least in contemporary perspective, Adam Smith actually, in the original Wealth of Nations,
absolutely not.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and that's been much misunderstood, but of course I should say this isn't an economic treatise, as you know.
Yeah.
This is a book about our lives and our future and our planet.
Yeah, and so let's not go down that road. But for example, the new economic map, you talk about the market economy, the government economy, and the illegal economy, which we're all pretty conscious of. These are the things that generally get discussed on the TV talk shows and whatnot. But there's also the natural economy, the household economy, and the unpaid community economy.
And not only is there also that, Tom, but those are the economies that are our life support systems. And yet, if you look at our economic indicators, they're nowhere to be found. So no wonder we have such bad bookkeeping. We get very bad policies, because what's not counted isn't considered in policy.
For example?
If you look at poverty now, and you look at it from the perspective that I'm proposing, that we give value and visibility to the work of caring and caregiving, 70% of those in our world living in absolute poverty are female. And, of course, it's women who do most of the caring work in households. And not only that, in these wealthy United States, women over 65 are twice as poor as men over 65. Most of these women are caregivers or were former caregivers. And yet we don't have what so many other nations have, and we're so behind. I mean, take the Nordic nations, Sweden, Finland, Norway. They have a generally high standard of living, and they have paid parental leave. They have allowances for caregivers, money, stuff that puts food on the table. They have training and education for caregiving in their schools. So naturally, they have longer lifespans. They have a better quality of life. They even rate very high in the World Economic Forum's Global Competitiveness Report. And they are investing in what economists love to talk about, human capital, which we're not doing. We're 42nd, according to a CIA report, on infant mortality. We're behind not just everybody in the industrialized world, but behind Andorra, behind Cuba. It has to change, and that's what this book is about.
Indeed, well said. You also, in the book, as you get deeper into the book here, this is a chapter 103, page 103, connecting the dots. You get back into the partnership and domination systems that you first really laid out in The Chalice and the Blade, as I recall, or perhaps it was one of your earlier books. It's been about a decade since I went on my Rhian Eisler reading binge for the very first time, and that Dan Quinn took a lot of this information, credited you in his book Ishmael. I referenced it in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. The whole idea that societies as a whole are not all identical, and that they're not all based on patriarchy, domination, and hierarchy. That there are societies that are different, and that we can reinvent our society to be different.
Absolutely, and we see that in all levels. Tribal societies, we see it in prehistoric societies, and I just mentioned the Nordic nations. Sure, they're not perfect, but you know they don't have the huge gaps between haves and have-nots that we do in so many, and that become much worse in periods of regression to what I call the domination system. I mean, again, what we're talking about here is a system, and yes, the status of women, how a society structures the roles and relations of the two halves of humanity, really plays a role, and yet it's ignored in so many analyses. For example, take the fact that we're always told that there's no money for caring for people or nature, you know, no money for environmental mm-hmm. housekeeping, no money for health care, no money for child care, but this is supposed to be, quote, women's work. It's associated with the stereotypically feminine, whether men or women do it. And it's devalued, but we're told there's money for prisons, for wars, for armaments. And these are, of course, stereotypically masculine. I do want to emphasize we're talking about stereotypes because so many men today are rejecting that definition of what it means to be a man.
Sure, and oddly enough, on the other side, there are some women who have embraced the old male stereotype. You look at Margaret Thatcher, for example, and I would say done a lot of harm to their societies as a consequence of it.
Well, you know, the token woman in a domination hierarchy like Thatcher, it proves every inch of the way that she's not too soft or feminine. Again, contrast that with Nordic nations. 40% of the legislature is female, of the national legislature. So they have much more caring policies. But it's not only that the women are in there in mass, it's that as the status of women rises, caring, caregiving, they are no longer so devalued by men. It's a systems dynamic, and we must begin to go really at the basic issue. What values drive our economic systems, be they capitalist or socialist? And most important, what can we do to change this? Because, as you know, the real wealth of nations is full of, well, what do we do now? And everything that has to be done and that we can do.
Yeah, and this gets back to this notion that I've been talking about for weeks now about for years, I suppose, the cultural consensus, the idea of changing society. We can do it. Your book is incredibly optimistic in this regard and lays out specific suggestions. It's absolutely brilliant. Rhian, I look forward to seeing you in Dubrovnik, Croatia in June.
Well, I'll be there on video.
Oh, you will? Okay. Well, that's great. I look forward to it. Rhian Eisler, her new book. We have to wrap it up. I'm sorry, Rhian. It's called The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating a Caring Economy. Rhian, thanks so much for being with us. 16 minutes past the hour. Dead in Virginia Tech shootings, the headline, University President's Statement, this from the Huffington Post. A tragedy that we consider of monumental proportions. Student, people jumped out of the top story window to escape. Deadliest incident of U.S. campus violence. White House Bush horrified However, the president believes there is a right for people to bear arms. And Larry Johnson saying, perhaps this can be a wake-up moment. And now these are not his words. I'm paraphrasing the sentiment of his blog over at noquarter.typepad.com, or .blogspot.com, excuse me. That perhaps this can be a moment for Americans to, an empathy moment, to get it for a second, what it must be like to live in a nation where every single day brings the death of many, many people. And now, Iraq only has a population of, as I recall, around 40, 45 million people, maybe it's 35 million. And, you know, they have 40, 30, 40, 50, 60, 80, 100 people dying every day there. We're a population of over 300 million and we have 22 people. That's not to say, that's not to minimize it in any way. This is a horrible, horrible tragedy. And as we look at what is happening in, at what is playing out right now in Virginia, or has played out, as we look at the coverage of it and the American response to it, the response of the American people, which will, you know, no doubt be, you know, oh my God, appropriately so. Let's use this as a moment to also identify with all humans all around the world who live in societies where this kind of thing is not the exception, but the norm. Look at the study that was done over the weekend, or that was published over the weekend, about this incredible percentage of children in Iraq who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, who are, you know, who have bedwetting, and 70% of primary school students, elementary school kids, 70% of primary school students in Baghdad suffer symptoms of trauma-related stress such as bedwetting or stuttering. This is from the Iraqi Ministry of Health. This is not from Amnesty International. An entire society that's experiencing profound post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence of George W. Bush and the Republican Party wanting to gin up a war in 2002 so that they could gain political capital and they could take back the Senate in the election of 2002. That they could put Democrats on the defensive and get them on the record. That they could maintain the war for at least a year and a half or so that Bush could carry it through the 2004 elections and get himself reelected, not have a short war like his daddy did, because his daddy's war wasn't long enough for him to be the war president when the election came around, and therefore he lost. As Bush pointed out to Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, back in 1999. To simply see the consequences of living of a society that says, well, there's a lot of oil there, you know, 20% of the world's oil, according to Dick Cheney. Iraq sits on a lot of oil. And now 600,000 dead people at our hand. At what point do we say enough is enough? Muqtada al-Sadr now, the Shia cleric, arguably the number two behind Sistani, and by the way, there were reports in the press last week that Sistani's health is deteriorating quite badly, and he might have gone back to Iran for medical treatment. Iran, excuse me. The Muqtada al-Sadr has now said to his compatriots in the Iraqi parliament, about a third, about 30%, a little more than 30% of the members of the Iraqi parliament were elected as essentially proxies, representatives of or on behalf of Muqtada al-Sadr. You'll recall Bush said, "No, we're going to take the Sadr guy out. We're not going to allow him to you know, run the show there anymore. He's, you know, he's toast." And he sent a bunch of soldiers into Sadr City to try to arrest Sadr. This was, what, 4 years ago? 3.5 years ago? And five of those soldiers were killed the first day in there. One of them was Casey Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan's son. And then Bush said, oops, We're going to let Sodder do, you know, he shoots back. We'll let him live. We'll let him run around loose. And, in fact, he can even participate in the elections, or his political party can. So a third of the seats in Parliament are representing Sodder. And Sodder is now saying to those people, that third of Parliament, get out. Don't participate with this government anymore. They're not going down the road we want to go down. This is a society in free fall as a consequence of the neoconservative, largely the economic policies, but also the political policies that were inflicted upon them by people like Paul Wolfowitz and George W. Bush. 27 minutes past the hour. Okay, so I told you that I would tell you what happened Friday night when I went to see Karl Rove. I figured, hey, it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. I'll check this thing out. I was even willing to make a $60 contribution, $120 for my wife and for Louise and I, to the Republican Party in order to be there. Although they gave me my money back and said, you know, we don't want you hanging out with the other donors, please, so you can stand back behind the rope there with the press, which, you know, I didn't want to be a jerk about it. I said, that's fine. You know, I'll be back here with the press. And along with, you know, local blogger Carla from loadedoregon.org and Felicia Heaton from KPOJ, our home station, a bunch of real reporters actually back there as well. So anyhow, I went and I heard Karl Rove, and he gave this talk, and he starts out with this little riff about being a Norwegian, and I'm thinking, oh no. And then he talks about Sparks, Nevada, and I've got my own history with that town. And having tried to hitchhike through it once in either 69 or 70 and with a friend of mine, and we got literally run out of town. You don't hitchhike through Sparks, Nevada, or at least you didn't back then. And I was all 19 years old or something. And then he goes, you know, it launches into his attack of the Democrats, his totally predictable attack on the Democrats, attack them where they're strong, on their economic policy, on their Iraq policy. And I went home and, you know, it was no big deal. The good news, by the way, of this whole thing is that, as by my count, and I sat back there for, you know, 40 minutes or so, and maybe an hour, if you consider all the time before he showed up, and then he talked for probably 20 minutes. Not a particularly good speaker, by the way, but, you know, what the heck, he's Karl Rove. And there were 109 people who were willing to pay $60 to hear him. That's the best Oregon could do, as far as I could tell. That's, I think, the good news for the anti-Karl Rove side, because I guarantee if Barack Obama had come to town, or even Hillary Clinton, for that matter, that there would have been a lot more than 109 people, even at $60 a head. In fact, the local newspaper, of course, reported it as 200 people. You always underreport protests, and you underreport protests and overreport Republican fundraisers. But in any case, I went home and told Louise about it, and then, you know, we went to sleep. And that night, I had Friday night for one of maybe a half a dozen times in my entire life, maybe not even that many, that I can remember having just god-awful nightmares. I mean, you know, I must have awakened three or four times, maybe five times during that night, you know, screaming or thrashing around or in a sweat, and they were nightmares. I remember one of them was just incredibly vivid of this plane being shot out of the sky with some sort of static electricity, just this, you know, everything just turning bright blue and then going and finding the plane and seeing the bodies and all that. It's just these blood and guts. And I've been in war zones. I was in Uganda in 1980 at the tail end of the war with Idi Amin. I've watched people die. I've seen recently cleaned up, but I down in the Medellin Valley in Bogota, I've seen what happens when massacres happen. I mean, firsthand, and it's, but you know, that and that gave me has given me some bad dreams, but nothing like this. I mean, it was just incredible. Just death and destruction dreams. And I woke up in the morning, and I said to, and I was telling Louise about it over breakfast at 3:30 in the morning, or 4. Actually, I think we slept in for Saturday morning. It must have been around 5. And I said, you know, I must just be, you know, I must be processing something. I don't know what it is. You know, maybe all the changes happening, you know, in progressive talk radio, or maybe it's, you know, I don't know what it is. And she said, you went to see Karl Rove last night. You spent an hour in a room with him. And it suddenly hit me. If you were able to get into, if I was able to get in a time machine and go back in Germany and sit for a little bit of time with Mr. Goebbels, it would be like facing pure evil. I mean, this is the guy who, you know, at the age of 19 was passing out flyers for a political opponent's rally to, you know, homeless folks and frat parties and whatnot, saying free booze, free broads, come on over, kind of thing. I mean, you know, the master of political dirty tricks, but it's gone from political dirty tricks at the age of 19 to 600,000 people dead in Iraq today. This guy's the architect of, in my opinion, mass murder. Not to mention the U.S. attorney scandal, which seems to be entirely flowing through his hands, and Gonzo Gate, the Iraq War, and all of this, this whole thing with the U.S. attorneys coming out of Rove's office, is to try to create what they refer to as a permanent Republican majority, which I would say is simply a fancy way of saying single-party rule. And if it's a permanent majority, that means single-party rule for the rest of the history of the United States, which means we're talking about reinventing the Politburo. And last night, Mike Malloy and I were talking about this off the air. We were at this party here in Phoenix for the listeners of 1480 AM KPHX. And he said, you know, it really highlights, he evoked Hannah Arendt, and he said it really highlights, you know, because I said, he seems so ordinary. And he said it really highlights the banality of evil, how banal it is, how it's just, you know, the people who did the Holocaust were like the bookkeepers, you know? It was just, let's do it by the numbers. Let's just, it's not the true believers. But the numbers crunchers, the true believers facilitated it or helped, you know, bring it about. The real outspoken, you know, the Wolfowitzes and the Feiths and the Pearls and the Bill Kristols, the ones who really, you know, truly believed the ideology. But it was the Karl Rove types, the win at any cost. It's not about the ideology. It's about being in power folks that were really at the core of that kind of evil. And that I think, frankly, are at the core of that kind of evil right here in the United States right now. So, anyhow, my Karl Rove story. Michael in New York City. Hey, Michael, welcome. Whoop. Michael?
Yes.
Yeah, you're live and on the air.
Oh, I'm so sorry. How are you doing?
Good.
Okay. Hello?
Try it again? Yeah.
Oh, I don't know what's going on here. Well, my problem is with the Don Imus firing situation. Mm-hmm. You know, people are really losing the focus of what the real problem is. Now, I'm a black man, and what Don Imus said is really, however stupid and hurtful, is not as criminal as Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh with their racist statements. I take into issue, I'm sure you know about the Sean Bell situation here in New York City, where an unarmed black man was killed by cops hours before his wedding. And yeah. Bill O'Reilly says that is no big deal. You people in the black community need to move on and get on with your lives, you know, hush up and so forth. and he made derogatory remarks about five African immigrants that were killed in the Bronx fire, saying that if they were in this country illegally in the first place, they'd be alive today. Like, who is he to make that statement?
No, I'm right there with you, Michael. And my point on this, and do a reality check for me, my point on this is that America is getting fed up with hate speech. America is getting fed up with race and gender and class being used as raw meat to try to activate the Republican base. And Don Imus happened to be the guy who, he was the straw that broke the camel's back. He happened to be the guy who had his big mouth open at just at that moment when America was ready to say enough already.
Well, no doubt about that. But then my problem is, what about the people that are on the media airwaves, the uttering stuff that can be deemed criminal? If they can fire Opie and Anthony for encouraging a lewd act in St. Patrick's Cathedral, and if they can fire a hip-hop disc jockey for jokingly making death threats to a rival hip-hop disc jockey, then why can't they fire O'Reilly and Limbaugh for making racist statements that can be deemed criminal? It's just like, you cannot be in a crowded movie theater and yell fire and then create a riot where people can be hurt or killed.
Yeah. It's a question that the American people, the advertisers, the businesses involved, and perhaps at some point even, you know, regulatory agencies are going to have to look into. Michael, thank you very much for your call and your comments. Kim and Eugene. Hey, Kim, just a few seconds here before we got to take a break.
Yeah, right. Now, how are you anyway? I admire you very much, sir. I think the next time you want to go see Roe or Bush or Cheney, be a block away with binoculars, you'll be safe, because it's the same problem with you when you buy a Ouija board. There's demons running with them, and they can.
So you think that what happened was that Rove's demonic helpers or whatever.
Sure. You know, they can influence your unconscious for a long time.
Yeah. Well, I want to be the first to testify. I'm telling you, I don't recall ever having dreams like that in my life. I mean, of that severity. I've had
you can always test it out and try it a second time. If it happens a second time, you know I'm right.
I'm not, I don't want to. You know, or if I do, I'm going to be wearing crosses and garlic and everything else. Kim, thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
You make great plans that span the sky, gave sight to the blind with other man's eyes. You can crush any country in a matter of weeks, so it don't make sense that you can't make peace.
Indeed. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Gabriel in Springfield, Mississippi. You're live in
Missouri.
Missouri, I'm sorry.
Yeah, Springfield, Missouri. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Gabriel.
You were the author of When Democracy Fails, right?
That's right, yeah. But I wrote that about 3 months after 9/11, the first draft of that. And,
yeah. I just wanted to compliment you on that. I love your writing in that situation. Anyway, I would like to comment on is the example that the president has set for the American people, in that here we have a preemptive war against Iraq, which, you know, it's legal, illegal, whatever. It's a preemptive war, and that teaches people to go straight to violence, that when you have a problem, go straight to violence. Add to that the fact that we used World War II surplus bombs. That sends a message to the world saying that we care more about saving money than protecting innocent lives. You got a vice president who...
Well, you know, a lot of those cluster bombs were brand new, Gabriel.
Yeah, a lot of
them. We also use some very, very sophisticated technology that kills a lot of children.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Which you know, calls into question the morality of... I mean, frankly, I believe that this is a violation of international conventions and treaties, the use of cluster bombs in civilian areas. I believe it's a war crime.
I believe so as well, but what I think is the most poignant point is the example that our leaders are setting for average citizens. When average citizens see George Bush behaving this way, what's to stop them from thinking, I can do the same thing? If he can do it, I can do it.
Right, and so they end up in Virginia shooting people? Is that the logical extension of what you're saying?
I think so.
Yeah. See, I think it's, I don't disagree with you entirely. I would say that it's more of, there's a whole bunch of different pressures pushing society, and somebody snapped in Virginia. And, you know, it may or may not have had anything to do with Iraq at all, but Iraq is contaminating the zeitgeist, the gestalt, the air that we breathe, the psychological air that we breathe, the emotional air that we breathe, the cultural air that we breathe. As you point out, this idea of, you know, kill them first before they can kill you. Well, maybe they don't want to kill you. Maybe you can work things out like we did with the Soviet Union. You know, maybe ultimately you can even make them our friends like they seem to be doing in the process of doing with China. It's just, yeah, good point, Gabriel. Thank you very much for the call and for making it. I think it's you know, well said. Peter in Vista, California. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to call because of the global warming fake controversies. My father, elderly father, listens to Fox News, and he tells me that the environmental wackos are all complaining about CO2, and so I guess that means, since we breathe out CO2, I guess that means they don't want us to breathe. And I try to explain to him, That's not the problem. That's just part of the normal carbon cycle that's been going on for 100 million years, and there's been no new added carbon since the Carboniferous age, 60
right.
million years before the dinosaurs. That's when all the coal and oil was laid down.
Yeah, and it was actually longer ago than that, but yes, the Carboniferous age, you know, 600 to 300 million years ago. And
I've got 345 to 280, but it doesn't matter. Millions of years ago. And it's been sitting there sequestered, this fossil CO2, and it hasn't been part of this carbon cycle on the surface of the Earth. It's been buried. And the problem is we're adding it, and so then we're adding this huge new source of carbon, which is the problem with the global warming. And the other thing that they confuse my father about is the difference between heat and temperature. He says, oh, I'd like it a little bit warmer. Yeah, that'd be nice in the winter. But that's a confusion. Heat is the...
It's the amount of energy contained by the atmosphere.
Right.
Temperature is the temperature that you experience at this moment. And as the amount of energy in the atmosphere goes up, the instability and the violence of the atmosphere increases, and the ability of the atmosphere to hold water vapor, which is also a greenhouse gas, increases, and it gets into this positive feedback loop. You know, good point and well made and spot on, Peter. Thank you for pointing that out. And in fact, I would add this for your father. You may want to check out the new Pew Research study. This just came out. And this is the first time, you know, everybody's talking about, oh, you know, younger generation getting all our news from Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. Isn't that a terrible thing? Okay, so they went down and the Pew Research Association, the Pew poll, you know, these are very totally, just painfully unbiased group. And they ask people, what's your primary source of news? And for those people whose primary source of news is the Fox News Channel, 32% of them could name who the Sunnis were. You know, could even name the Sunnis. 32%. People who watch The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, 50%. People who knew who Scooter Libby was. If you watch the Fox News Channel, only 29% of people who watch the Fox News Channel knew who Scooter Libby was. 44% accurately knew who he was. 44% Daily Show, Colbert Report. People who knew who Vladimir Putin was, Vlad the Impaler, the guy who's the president of Russia. 38% of Fox News, only 38% of people who watch Fox News had any idea who Vladimir Putin is. People who watch The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, 52%. Now, this is startling. And then you look back at the study that they'd done in 2003, where they laid out three false claims: that Iraq possessed WMD, that Iraq was involved with 9/11, that Iraq was that there was international support for the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. And the Pew researchers said, those who receive most of the news from Fox News are more likely than the average to have misperceptions, three times more likely than the next nearest network to hold all three misperceptions. This is tragic. Thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back tomorrow. We'll be back in Portland, Oregon. We'll be broadcasting live from our home studio at KPOJ. Have a great day. Take very good care of yourself. And remember, don't ever forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.